Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
We have indeed a distinguished panel. Cornelia Parker RA is well known for her large-scale, often site-specific installations. She's an artist who engages with the fragility of existence and the transformation of matter, working with a range of mediums, and we'll see some of that today by in images. Cornelia has collaborated with all sorts of institutions, such as HM Customs and Excise, the British Army, Madame Tussauds in London, and even the National Rifle Association. She was nominated for the Turner Prize in 1997. She was appointed an officer of the Order of the British Empire in 2010. On the other side of the panel, Christian Marclay is a visual artist and a composer whose work explores the juxtaposition between sound recording, photography, video, and film. His installations and video film collages display provocative musical and visual landscapes have been included in exhibitions at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, the Venice Biennale, the Centre Pompidou in Paris, the Kunsthaus in Zurich, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, among others. And Dr. Ros Holmes is a junior research fellow at the University of Oxford, specializing in modern and contemporary Chinese art and online visual culture, so we are very happy to have her as a replacement because, of course, also especially of Ai Weiwei and his exhibition. Her doctoral dissertation examined how the discourse of Wen Ming, translated as civilization or civility, has been visualized in 20th century art in China, with a particular emphasis on contemporary practice. She previously worked in Beijing as the program manager of a contemporary art space and as the assistant curator for education at the Ulen Center for Contemporary Art. The occasion for this discussion on the ready-made and destruction in art is the Ai Weiwei exhibition at the Royal Academy, which I trust most, if not all of you, will have visited by now. So I think it is the background against which we shall discuss these general issues. So I would like to start with Ai Weiwei and mention the fact that there is something intriguing about his relationship with objects, and especially objects that can be regarded as part of heritage and that should be preserved. So I became famous with actions, what can call iconoclastic actions, so with treating objects of cultural heritage, let's say badly, damaging or destroying them. So for instance, this famous, and you have seen it in the exhibition, triptych, Dropping a Han Dynasty Urn, of 1995, where he's shown letting an ancient vase drop. And as he said, being grabbed by weight and gravity, falling to the ground and breaking, all the while looking directly at you. Or adding paint on a vase while leaving, in some cases at least, the original ancient decoration visible through it, but of course adding a layer to it that does not belong, or then also dripping some of these ancient vessels into acrylic paint, and therefore making the original surface disappear. Yet he also has been drawing attention to the rampant destruction of Chinese cultural and urban heritage, and even turning some of the remnants that he has been able to save or salvage as a sort of relics. So a case is the souvenir from Beijing of 2002, with bricks from dismantled house in Hutong, wood from destroyed Qing dynasty temples, and that's an addition. And of course, this sort of information comes with it, so it accompanies, and so the knowledge of what this comes from is part of the piece, and you have seen a lot of it in the exhibition as well. He also referred to the destruction brought to Asian art and archaeology by the Western powers and by the art market. For instance, here in Buddha feet, and you see with these fragments, supposed to be fragments that indeed were left by people who could only take the upper part of the statues. And in a current double exhibition in Beijing, he reconstructed an ancestral temple or hall from the Yangtze province of the early Ming dynasty that had been dismantled following the effects of the Cultural Revolution. So I bought these pieces, all the pieces of this large structure from a local businessman and had them rebuilt, or had the building rebuilt across the wall separating two galleries which had invited him simultaneously in Beijing, the Galleria Continua and the Tang Contemporary Art here. So the building crosses, if you wish, this bridge. So here we don't have destruction, we rather have a sort of, I would say, restoration. And something similar seems to that we could say about this major piece presented now in the exhibition, Strait, in which these reinforcing bars salvaged from ruins of the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, which had been completely distorted, then were straightened by him or his collaborators. And here also, we have something that seems to be rather restorative. So my first question is to Ros Holmes, who's a specialist of Chinese contemporary art and in this Chinese context. How should we understand this, to me, rather paradoxical or maybe even contradictory relationship to the destruction of artifacts and heritage? On the one hand, a sort of avant-gardist iconoclasm, and on the other hand, a critique of the official or financially speculative vandalism. Is it a case of contradictions? Is it an irony, maybe? Is it an evolution in his work?
Thank you, Dario. I mean, I think those are questions which are very pertinent to all of Ai's work. And I think he really plays with all of those meanings at the same time. There's a very playful manipulation which happens in his works, whereby there's these multiple sort of layers of meanings, which I think he also tries to evoke. And I think an underlying sort of thread which runs throughout this constant series is the whole idea of, you know, what do we value and why? Who gets to assign value to certain objects and who gets to authorize that? And I think especially we see that in his ceramic works. You started off by showing Ai dropping a Han Dynasty urn. And this is sort of seen, obviously, as a very sort of provocative, iconoclastic act. The very fact, as well, as you mentioned, that his gaze and his facial expression is exactly the same from the first shot to the last shot. So that whatever sort of response is in the viewer's mind is left purely to the spectator. If you sort of notice that this, he reduces this act to almost being something extremely ordinary. Now, this whole series, which obviously began whenever he returned from New York to Beijing about 1993, he began to produce a series of ceramic works, of which the first one was called Coca-Cola Han, which you showed immediately afterwards. So these ideas of sort of value and authenticity, you know, has this work in some ways been sullied by the incorporation of this sort of logo which has been emblazoned around the vase? Or has it been in some ways sort of its value has been elevated through the act of doing this? I mean, many of these artifacts perhaps are not necessarily of museum quality, and yet they are definitely significantly imbued with sort of material and cultural value. And I think the interesting thing to note about these ceramics as well is that they really form part of the canon of the beginning of Chinese ceramics, and form part of the sort of Neolithic societies who are credited with forming the origin of Chinese civilization. And this is a history which can therefore said to stretch back 5,000 years into the past. And this is a sort of number which is constantly even invoked by the current government in many ways to sort of, you know, that proclaim themselves therefore as the inheritor and the protector of this history and this tradition. And they therefore use that as well, you could say, to sort of buttress their own claims to authenticity and legitimacy. So I think, is in many ways sort of asking us to question who gets to own that history, that ownership of meanings. Do they get to own it, or do I get to own it by destroying this artifact or by repurposing it? And I think he constantly asks the viewer to really think about their own cultural conceptions, about where those come from. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of sort of questions about, are these really authentic objects that he destroys? You know, people, yes. So there's an interesting incident which actually happened quite early on, actually, in Ai's career. So this was in 1998. He participated in an exhibition in New York at Max Protech Gallery, which was called Double Kitsch. And it featured about the work of about 9 or 10 Chinese artists. And I contributed to that exhibition with this work, which is called Coca-Cola Tang from 1997. Again, it's one of these sort of Neolithic vases which he inscribed with the Coca-Cola logo, which you can see here. Now, at the conclusion of the exhibition, the gallery actually shipped back Ai's work to Beijing with the accompanying statement. I'm afraid maybe you can't read this. I'll try to read it out. So basically they said, dear Ai, oh no, this is actually to the gallery owner, during shipment back to Beijing, the pot was actually broken because they sent it via FedEx. Yes, exactly. So it was sent via FedEx. It got broken in the process. Of course, then I obviously complained and sort of said, what are you doing? And they said, well, we felt that we were essentially burdened with the transportation of a work which was not didn't purport to what it was actually, what it was, right? They said, this is actually, it's not a real pot, it's fake. And therefore, we felt that we were misled. Now, I obviously, as you can imagine, was rightly felt extremely angry at this. Therefore, there was a sort of a torrent of communications that went back and forth between himself and the gallery in New York. And they sort of said, well, the insurance company is not going to pay for this. We've ascribed it a value of $50. Yes. So then I had it actually shipped to Oxford and to undergo a thermoluminescence test, which is actually used to verify how old these pots actually are. And the conclusion was that it was actually 800 years older than I had originally thought. So it was, in fact, even older than the Tang Dynasty. So you can imagine then he felt obviously rightly justified in doing this. And he actually re-exhibited this work almost 10 years after that original exhibition. This is from an exhibition in Beijing. And you can see actually the vase, which is put in this small box. He actually had the missing pieces sort of glued back together. And he put all the documentation, including the faxes from that event, are sort of displayed alongside it. So I think he's really about, you know, turning these ideas of authenticity, of value on their head, and also playing with these dichotomies of, you know, how is value ascribed, by whom, you know, by the art world, by, you know, is it the gallery that decides that they are the ones that can, you know, that get to ascribe that value. So I think that's why, you know, it's very interesting provocation, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much. I would gladly also ask Cornelia and Christian how they feel about, and if they have any observations about AI's way of dealing with objects and of using and reusing and recycling, in a sense, objects, some of which are more or less old, some which were purposefully discarded or destroyed, some which he had actually made, but after using ancient traditional techniques. And also, do you think that the term ready-made, which was proposed for this discussion, is it appropriate in that case or not? So
obviously, I use the found object in my work a lot. And, you know, Yvonne Blaswick wrote this great essay for me for a publication I had about the idea of the ready-made versus the found object, you know, and her, you know, discussion of that subject was that a found object is something that's had a history. The ready-made is something straight off the shelf, new, you know, like the Duchamp's urinal or something you can go and buy that's mass-produced. So I think, you know, for me, I always thought I was interested in the found object rather than the ready-made, although I'm a huge fan of Duchamp too. So he's obviously using these found objects which have all this cultural baggage attached, whereas the ready-made is not yet got cultural baggage attached. It's kind of fresh off the shelf, as it were. So I mean, you were saying earlier about it's 100 years old, the idea of the ready-made, you know, and that's... And now we're very used to seeing found, you know, found and new objects in work. I think, you know, that using these things like temples and pottery, things that are actually undervalued in China. Now I think it's going the other way, isn't it? I think Chinese are suddenly realising now they're acquiring lots of wealth, that a lot of this stuff that they weren't interested in 20 years ago, they're really rushing to the auction houses to buy up. So I had obviously bought these things when they were reasonably cheap for him to be able to destroy or, you know, get vast quantities of wood from temples. But I think it, you know, it parallels quite a lot of things I've been doing in my own work for the last whatever years.
You know, in New York, there's antique shops full of this stuff.
Yes.
So it's almost like this, so much of it. And I don't know much about pots, but you know, the fact that there's this large quantity of them available makes the act of destroying it less destructive, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think perhaps in China too, where things are still being assessed, you know, about the Cultural Revolution and where these artifacts fit into their history and them being undervalued. And I mean, is it in Japan where they destroy things all the time and move temples around?
Well, there is the famous case of the Ise Shinto Shrine, which is reconstructed every 20 years. Now, the question of how typical is that is a bit another one, because they do also keep and preserve things. But there is this idea that has been used a lot of an East-West opposition around this issue, the West valuing, supposed to be valuing more material authenticity, that is keeping the stuff itself from the past, with the idea of John Ruskin that the value of a building is in the last inch of its surface, and if you take it away, it's gone, and therefore restoration is the worst destruction that there can be, because you replace a building with a false description of what it was. That's Ruskin's idea. And the East would be on the side of preserving not material authenticity, but the way you do things, the knowledge of how you do it, and the form, which would be the case in the Isra Shrine. I believe that things are much more complex, because wooden architecture in the West, for instance, is only exists further because it is constantly being reconstructed, and actually the same is true of stone architecture to a large extent. But indeed, but there is this question of how, where does authenticity lie, which I think is also quite important. Maybe we could indeed come to this question of the ready-made, and then I think we'll come indeed to the works you want to show us. But I wanted to ask Christian, who is, because he's also working with music and sound. And sound is reputed, although it has material supports of all sorts, instruments, musicians, a room, a record, and so on. But sound itself, or music itself, is regarded as immaterial. So can one destroy it? Can one damage it? Can one break it? So what is your answer?
It isn't immaterial anymore, in the sense that we found ways to record music and through records, for instance, vinyl records, or before that, you know, even more fragile materials. And strangely enough, now music has become digital and is in a way more immaterial than it was. So it's a lot harder to break an original. So the idea of something original is a fiction in a way. What you were talking about made me think about musical instruments, which is also quite interesting in collecting or preserving, trying to preserve these ancient instruments. There's kind of two schools. One is, you know, you preserve them, you don't touch them, you dust them once in a while. And another is you actually play these instruments, because they have to be played to stay alive. And I think a lot that's maybe a nice image to put on top of Ai Weiwei's work, because he's full of contradictions, and I think of him more as someone who's trying to preserve his heritage. You know, sometimes you have to do destructive acts to make people pay attention. It's maybe a desperate act, but in the end, you know, you get attention. I think in the show, the piece that moved me the most was the one with the ray bar, where he's, you know, tediously straightening out these bars, which is a very absurd kind of gesture. It's the opposite of the ready-made, in a sense. And it's also looking at a material in architecture which is completely hidden and that we don't pay attention to. It's sort of this inside structure, this skeleton that keeps everything together. And in the case of these schools that were destroyed by an earthquake, these were underused. So there's a nice contradiction there.
So I like the idea that he, you know, they didn't use enough of them, and mm-hmm. and they became, you know, mangled by the pressure. And then what he's done is made them fit for purpose, but through a very violent means. You know, each of those bars has had 200 blows to make it straight again. So it's all this energy that's gone into unbending what nature did in seconds. You know,
I mean, this issue that you between the difference between the ready-made and the found object, in a way. I've become known also for breaking things, but breaking records. When I was starting my career as a sort of DJ, which I don't like the word, but mixing records and really destroying the vinyl as a way to react against this idea that something so free and so immaterial would then become frozen and turn into an object. And I've always had an ambiguous relationship to recording, because somehow we want to be able to document certain performances and sound performances, and at the same time I want to honor the people who witnessed it live, because the thing about music for me, which is essential, is a social act. You know, it's something that you share with a group of musicians, but also with an audience. Then as a recording, it becomes totally out of your hands, and it becomes more of a private object that one listens as they wish. Or
what do you think about all the illicit tapes that were made? You know, I was thinking of Bob Dylan's concert where somebody shouted out, was it Heretic, or, you know, I forgot what he said. What did they say? But it was amazing to capture that, and that was, you know, a really iconic moment. But there was somebody there recording that, and that a lot of people can't be there, you know, because they weren't alive then. But what do you think about those kind of live tapes?
Well, yeah, they have an, you know, I mean, we all depend on recordings, visual and sound recordings. But there is something magical about sound being ephemeral. And I think I was always attracted to that dimension. So I felt the recording was limiting. Yet, I found that by damaging this fragile surface of a vinyl, that I could open up endless possibilities. So, in fact, in the destructive act, there is a creative act as well. A scratch on a vinyl becomes, can potentially become a rhythm in the music. So, the work was more about, you know, building a new sound vocabulary out of this destruction of this. Multiple, and so in this case, it's very much a ready-made, because records are usually pressed in the thousands, the scratch on a record is unique. I did this piece in 1989 called Footsteps, where I recorded my footsteps, myself walking in the studio, and then made a one-sided record. 12-inch record of this recording, which was then glued to the floor of a gallery as a tiling, and people were invited to walk on them. I mean, this is not exactly the same. These are records that are found records, but I had made a record specifically to be in a similar installation. So you have to go back. I mean, today records are not the medium of choice, so. Most people are not familiar with the handling of records and how fragile they are. And the idea of actually stepping on a record is not as destructive today as it was in the 80s. And that's an interesting...
I loved it when records were made of shellac, which I think is a kind of secretion from a beetle. So I like the idea that you're listening to a diamond on top of...
Yeah. And vinyl. You know, vinyl was made out of oil, which is deteriorating matter, maybe skeletal. It was really about mashing up as much different styles of music together, and not... There's no hierarchy between, you know, pop music, classical music, or whatever. It's all material out there on a piece of plastic that was for me very cheap to use. You know, I never spent more than a dollar on a record. Mm-hmm. This stuff was made with junk. Maybe to some it's still junk, but to me it's, you know, part of the creative process.
Mm-hmm. I think it also raises the question of how far, what is the limit between extending the uses or putting to unexpected uses objects, can be musical instruments or it can be recordings, and actually damaging them or destroying them. So maybe I'm reminded, and we could move to the first work that I saw by you, Cornelia, which is a bit further, and that was in, it happened to be in Fort Worth, Texas, in the Museum of Modern Art. Glimmering objects floating in space, suspended in the air, like a sort of road, if you wish, and all of them symmetrical. Seen from closer, these objects turned out to be made of silver, silver plates, silver cups, and candlesticks, and so on, visibly crushed. The result emphasized their symmetry, by the way the piece is called Rocha. As I said, after a first sight of beauty, there was this sense of violence also, and of something have been really treated in a way that it was not intended to be. So I found that tension interesting, intriguing. So I wanted to ask you, how important is the violence in this?
Well, it's very important. I've got more refined over the years with my violent acts. And this was a later silver piece, which I used a 250-ton press to squash it, which meant I had to squash very nicely made objects because the soldiers wouldn't cope with, you know, the pressure. So I had to really... And then also, I had to squash a lot of things to get symmetrical things. Most of the things I squashed were symmetrical.
So then there was a refuse of this.
Yes, but, you know, my earlier sort of process was a bit more crude, which was a steamroller, which was only 10 tons. So after doing this piece, which now, I mean, in 1988... The squashing happened in 88, 89 was this piece, so it's quite old. But this is now owned by the Tate, and now the Tate have got all these fragmented objects, which I, you know, were all very cheap and nasty, actually, but they broke up with the 10 tons. And now they've made beautiful, you know, mm-hmm. velvet-like drawers for all these objects, all these fragments. It's quite extraordinary. But the piece you saw in Fort Worth is a later piece where it was quite a long time and I didn't squash anything. I was doing ploughing through all kinds of other destructive ways of making things. But then I was drawn back to squashing. And it's somehow one of my favourite activities.
The fact there's something so childish and so pleasurable in destroying something. I mean, we shouldn't forget that aspect of it, you know.
I squashed loads of two brass bands worth of instruments, and one was for the V&A in 2001.
Without the players.
Without the players, yeah. And I used the lifting mechanism of Tower Bridge to squash. You know, they had these 20-ton pistons, and so it was for the British galleries of the V&A. So that's why I used this famous British monument, you know, the bridge. And I thought at first I was going to squash them between the bits of the road when they came down, but that wasn't very practical. But the instruments I squashed were clapped out wind instruments. They had a lot of breaths go through them. I bought them from the British Legion, from, you know, colliery bands and, Salvation Army, but they were defunct. I like the idea that it had all these breaths through them, and then I'd just squash the last breath out of them. And the V&A at the time had this display of musical instruments, which were all beautifully carved and inlaid, and harpsichords and violins. And they also had lots of ceiling roses, which had musical illusions, you know, harps and violins and all the rest of it. So I created this floating ceiling rose with a fanfare of squashed instruments, and it was called Breathless.
Could you record the last breath, actually?
I could have done, but I didn't. But Michael Nyman, who's a wonderful musician and composer, he made a piece for the opening of the V&A's, the British galleries, and he made it based on my brass band, squash brass band, so it's a nice... And there was a brass band playing his piece underneath it the night of the opening. But the brass band community seemed to really like it, which I liked.
Was it organised the way the band would be displayed, or...
Well, it was formerly, you know, the big instruments, the medium instruments, and the small instruments. So it was by size. It's like my exploded shed, you know, small objects, medium objects. Yes. You know, my shed blown up. And this army blowing up the piece for me. But that piece was organized, formalized by small objects near the light, medium objects, and big objects, and then the wood. And I was trying to put the shed back together again, so a bit like Ai Weiwei with destroying something and then reconstituting it. But the shadows from the light bulb created the explosion again, which is something I didn't really realise was going to happen, so that was a really nice accident that happened. So it's a formalized explosion, but the shadows makes it the explosion happen again.
I like your idea of the destroying, I would say, innocent activity, or at least, I mean, it has this childish, this playful side to it. It's also sort of a way of knowing, because you know how something is made when you break it, and you see how it can react and what it can do, something you was not made to do, but it can do it also. Yet at the same time, of course, there can be some more uneasy, unheimlich side to that, because of the violence, because of the danger. And I remember, for instance, Christian, in your, there are two videos I was reminded of, one which you show that was included in the recent exhibition at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., called Damage Control, Destruction in Art Since the 1950s, and that's Guitar Drag of 2000, and where one sees a guitar, you'll correct me, but it's been slowly destroyed and very noisily, actually, destroyed by being dragged behind a car, behind a truck or a pickup truck on the road and then out of the road in Texas. And that referred, among other things, but to the murder of James Byrd Jr. in Texas in a rather similar way. So once you know that, of course, it's you can't just enjoy the strange and also, well, aggressive music. And another later video called Solo of 2008 does not involve destruction. It's a different interaction with an unexpected true interaction with a electric guitar. It's a woman played by Tree Carr making love in quite impressive way with a Fender Stratocaster. It's also very noisy. But what they have in common, I believe, is that the guitar there, and maybe it's not by chance that it's a musical instrument which comes alive, at least when it's played, is treated almost as a person. I don't mean to say it's a substitute for a person, but certainly it's almost a person, and that's what often happens in cases of iconoclasm, including those, some of which we are witnessing currently, is that their importance, the charge that is that they are almost as important and as persons. Sometimes they are mistreated as persons would be, and that happened already in the Reformation, that happened in many times. So it's also our relationship with objects that is at play. So I don't know whether you would like to add something to it.
Yeah, I mean, both of these pieces play on the fact that a guitar is very anthropomorphic. So, you know, it has a neck, it has a body. Often musicians might give their guitar a human name, but the interest in making sounds with guitar, there's also this whole tradition of how to mistreat an instrument, to try to expand the idea of the instrument and to make it sound differently. You know, of course, there's the destructions of guitar in rock and roll, which have become iconic. And if you don't break a guitar, it's not a rock show anymore. But this was apparently a reaction to these big outdoor concerts where you had to exaggerate the movement and make things more spectacular than they were. I mean, if you think about it, a guitar player makes these small finger gestures. It's all very miniature and amplified to a very loud sound. But when I started making music in the late 70s, I was very attracted to unusual guitar player, like one of first guitar show that really impressed me was by Fred Frith, a British guitar player who I saw in New York, who was playing his guitar flat on a table and doing all kinds of things to it, at some point drilling a hole into the body of the guitar. So it was this interest in how I have throughout the 80s performed with many musicians who are always trying to discover a new way to play their instruments So these projects come out of that as well. But of course they have other layers. I think, you know, one thing I just thought about right now is that both Cornelia's exploded shed, came out from a residency you had in Texas, and it didn't.
No, I made it in 91, that piece, but I did do a residency in Texas.
But you did something about a burned church, no?
Let me just show you quickly what I did in Texas. I did this piece.
This one, which was a burnt church.
Which was a white congregation church that had been struck by lightning and burnt to the ground. And I went out and collected the charcoal remains of it, but in Texas, and I talked to the minister about it, and he said, "Oh, I think it was an act of God." Oh, no, I said it was an act of God. And, I said, "What do you think of this being an act of God? You know, what does that say?" And he said, "Oh, I think God wanted me to have a better church."
Did he do it?
So he burned it down.
that makes him suspicious.
For his insurance. Yes,
but then, very quickly after that, some guys turned up in some pickups, and they were measuring up the church, and then they said that they were church builders and they were going to rebuild the church. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, this is very speedy, you know, it's only just burned down. And they said, and I said, well, you know, that's amazing. You know, they said, well, we go all over Texas building churches that are burnt down. I said, wow, do they get struck by lightning all the time? They said, no, they usually are black congregation churches that are burnt down by arsonists, and that happens all the time. This was 1997.
And so they were on the heels of the arsonists, these builders.
Yeah, well, they were good people who wanted to rebuild the... So these were,
not... Just asking.
No, they weren't getting paid, they were volunteers.
So it wasn't a racist act? Or?
This one wasn't, but this one was. The next one is this other piece.
Okay.
So in 1997, I did a church struck by lightning, very naive in Texas, thinking this is a place where things get struck by lightning, not thinking that things got burned down by arsonists. And then, so these guys said, well, we go around all the time that it happens. So I put a Google alert on when I got back to Britain on burnt churches. And I watched with horror as day in, day out, year in, year out, in the southern states of America, churches are being burnt down all the time as a racist act. Mm. And I was really horrified. So I meant to do a diptych to the piece called Mass. And this is Anti-Mass, which I made in 2005, which was a church from Kentucky that had been arsoned by Hell's Angels, who used to ride up on the porch of the church when they were trying to have services. Mm. And in the end, they'd burnt the church down. Mm. So there was Mass and Anti-Mass. Curiously enough, talking about things like institutions buying work, the original piece has been bought by Phoenix Art Museum, and I thought they might want to buy this one to go with it, as it was a diptych. But they didn't, you know. They felt it was too politically charged, so the museum in De Jong in San Francisco bought it instead, and they were much more liberal kind of. Yeah. So it's kind of curious to do as a politics.
From the place, right? They were not affected in the same way, I would imagine.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they're most probably not dissimilar distances apart, but politically, they're huge.
Politically, right?
I just thought it was an interesting parallel with guitar drag, which was a reaction to a racist crime in Texas. Where James Byrd was dragged to his death by two white suprematists. Texas does have
I'm married
a lot
to Texan,
of violence.
By the way. They're not all bad.
I think we could go on for the whole evening, but we have come to an end to this discussion. So thank you very much to all of you, and thank you to the audience. And we'll call it a day.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.